You're in the studio.
Oh, totally, totally. We'll see you next week.
I didn't
week.
Wear it because it's a subject of dispute, whether it was meant for me or whether it was meant for Sally.
This is Janet McKean from Caro, and you're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM, hands-on radio.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Arthur and Karen of Hoover, Alabama. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You, too, can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
Radio broadcast, this I believe.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant.
This is Tom Rowe. You can go to the newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about anything you hear here.
Michael Goot reports for the Post Star that a U.S. District Court judge September 30th dismissed a case New York and three other states filed challenging the constitutionality of the 2017 federal tax reform plan. New York, New Jersey, Maryland, and Connecticut filed a lawsuit over the $10,000 cap on the amount of state and local taxes that could be deducted on a federal return. The suit claimed the tax law unfairly penalizes Democratic-run states. Quote, there is no doubt in my mind that President Trump's unfair tax policy targets New York and other blue states by funding tax cuts for corporations and the rich on the backs of New Yorkers, unquote, he said. Read more about this story at the Post Star.
Diane Vounden is reporting for the Columbia paper. The town of Ancrum officials bid farewell to longtime appointed assessor Ken Leggett September 19th. He served in the position for 12 years. Leggett, a Livingston resident, started working on that town's highway crew in September 1974. He went on to become the elected assessor there in 1980. He leaves his assessor position in both Ancrum and Livingston as of September 30th. The Ancrum Town Board voted unanimously to appoint longtime Gallatin assessor Renee DeLue to fill the town's assessor post for a 6-year term beginning October 1st. And you can read the full story in the Columbia paper.
Nikki Schwab and Bob Fredericks report in the New York Post that Republican New York Congressperson Chris Collins resigned September 30th. The Buffalo area lawmaker resigned the day before he was expected to plead guilty in Manhattan federal court to insider trading charges. Governor Andrew Cuomo can either call a special election or leave the seat vacant until the next general election in November 2020. If he calls a special election, he could time it with village elections next March or with the presidential primary election in April. Read more about this story in the New York Post.
Dan Friedman is reporting for the Times Union. Small family farms, especially those in upstate New York, are still idealized as the backbone of America, but price fluctuations, oversupply, more frequent hurricanes, and constant squeezing by middlemen and grocery chains have made it difficult for many farmers to make a living, particularly in the fresh fruit and vegetable sector. In New York alone, the number of farms declined by 6% between 2012 and 2017, and nearly 11,000 acres of vegetable were taken out of production. Chris Poleski of Poleski Farms outside of Goshen told a reporter, and I quote, I don't even encourage my own children to go into farming anymore. It eats me up inside. But how do I, in good conscience, tell them that farming is good when I'm $250,000 in debt and I'm at the mercy of the market situation and the weather, end quote. Last week, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand sent a letter to the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture calling for a review of the pricing structure of the fresh fruit and vegetable industry. Gillibrand wrote it, and I quote, poses a risk to our food security as we rely more on the production of foreign nations, leading to our current $2.1 billion fruit and vegetable trade deficit, end quote. Data gathered by Gillibrand's staff shows that over the last 20 years, wholesale prices for broccoli, green beans, cabbage, and apples have gone up more rapidly than what farmers receive for that same produce. Tom Stenzel, president and CEO of the United Fresh Produce Association, wrote in a statement, and I quote, the fresh produce industry operates on extremely tight margins. Our industry is the ultimate supply and demand economy, and our real goal must be to increase demand for fresh fruit and vegetables. That's the key to raising prices paid to farmers, end quote. Gillibrand said she planned to introduce legislation that provides for real-time pricing to farmers, and I quote, so they're no longer left in the dark, end quote. Read the full story in the Times Union.
Sarah Trafton reports for Columbia Green Media that first responders from State Department of Environmental Conservation Rangers, the Caro Fire Department, Caro Police, Round Top Fire Department, Hensonville Fire Department, State Police, and the Greene County Sheriff's Office responded to a fire on Blackhead Mountain September 27th. Quote, it was most likely due to an unattended campfire, unquote, Ranger Rob Dawson said September 30th, noting an illegal campsite too close to the trail there. About 434 square feet of forest at 3,300 feet in elevation was burnt by the fire that took 20 hours to extinguish. Weather forecasters in Albany say rain for the area north of the Greene County Mountain is about 3/4 of an inch below normal, while in Poughkeepsie it is 3 inches below normal for the past month. Forecasters are predicting lots of rain later this week, though. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com.
Amelia Teasdale is reporting in the Columbia paper. The Chatham Village Planning Board met September 23rd to review and approve plans for a new single-screen movie theater at 4 Depot Square. The building to be constructed will face the train station that houses a branch of Community Bank and next to the Harrington's Building Supply Store. The theater will be built by Jack Shear and run by the Crandall Theater, a nonprofit organization. The new theater is intended to supplement the Crandall's existing offering and part of a plan to complete the renovation of the historic larger theater at 48 Main Street. The Depot Square building will have about 11 rows of seats as well as a lobby. The planning board waived the parking requirements for the project and voted unanimously to approve the site plan. All four board members were present. Aaron Gaylord, who represented Shear at the meeting and is responsible for the construction, said they hope to have the project completed within a year. Read the full story in the Columbia paper.
Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics that Democrat Karen Smith announced over the weekend that she will try again to win the Hudson Valley State Senate seat now held by Republican Senator Sue Serino. The 41st Senate District represents Dutchess and Putnam counties. Smith is selling new Democratic control of the Senate as a reason to vote for her. Quote, our communities need state resources, and as a member of the new Senate majority, I will fight tirelessly to address the diverse needs of our towns and cities. During these challenging times, we need a state government that works for all of us, and I am committed to being a fighter for Dutchess and Putnam counties, unquote, she said. Serino has held the seat since beating Democrat Terry Gibson in 2014, and she also beat Smith in 2018. Nick Reisman has that story at New York State of Politics.
Sarah Tapton is reporting for Columbia Green Media. Students from Cornell University are coming to Catskill to assess the area and provide information that will be used for the town's new comprehensive plan. Approximately a dozen graduate and undergraduate students from Cornell's City and Regional Planning Department will collect data on October 5th and 6th. The information will eventually be compiled into a report and delivered to the town in December. The project is being undertaken in conjunction with the Hudson River Estuary Program. Catskill Town Supervisor Doreen Davis said, and I quote, it's an extraordinary opportunity to have this level of expertise and not have to budget for it, end quote. The town board made an informal commitment to review the comprehensive plan in February and applied for a State Department of Environmental Conservation Community Smart Growth Grant in June to help with the process. Davis said the idea behind taking inventory of scenic resources is to balance conservation and economic growth. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com.
And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXC website, WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day.
Your forecast for the next 2 days. Well, on Tuesday, partly sunny with a high near 77 degrees. Tuesday night, a chance of showers and thunderstorms. It will be mostly cloudy with a low of around 64. And on Wednesday, a chance of showers and thunderstorms, partly sunny with a high near 72 degrees. Wednesday night, showers are likely mainly before 2 a.m. It will be partly cloudy with a low of around 48. So there you have your weather update brought to you by WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia counties.
Listen out for these live broadcasts and extra web streams on the WGXE program schedule during the coming week. On Thursday, October 3rd, WGXE Live will carry a live web stream from the Avalon Lounge in Catskill of an evening curated by the Workers Unite Film Festival, featuring a tribute to local artist Bruce Anderson and performances from Brooklyn-based Color Collage, Catskill's Gary's Dream, and Palinville's Potted Plant, plus a screening of Final Cuts. The webcast begins at 7 p.m. at wgxc.org/listen and is also on 90.7 FM after 8 p.m. until 10 p.m., when it will continue as a webcast at wgxc.org/listen. On Friday, October 4th, WGXC Live will carry a live web stream from the Avalon Lounge in Catskill. It's Just Pythons is a Catskill-based grunge band with Danny Scher of Horse Torso on drums, Chad Vizior of Blacklist on bass, Aaron Martin of the Aaron Martin Band on lead guitar, Liam Singer on keys and synth, and Mel Flannery of Kevin Morby on rhythm guitar and vocals. The Hudson-based rock band Aaron Martin Band also performs, as well as bassist and composer C.J. Boyd, who uses low-end loops and voices in order to try and stop time. DJ Legend performs after the bands. There should be a live web stream at WGXC.org around 9 p.m. Click on Listen Now at the top of the page and scroll down to find the live web stream. The show will air on 90.7 FM until 10 p.m., then continue as a web stream at wgxc.org/listen. See theavalonlounge.com for more information. Be sure to check our program schedule for new listings of public events, community meetings, and other dedicated web streams which may not have been posted at the time this announcement was recorded. You can also download the free Wavefarm app to listen on your phone or iDevice, or use it to become a broadcast partner with WGXC.
There are so many events on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org, and you can add your own by pressing the Add an Event button right there on the page. If you do, folks like me will read your community event on the radio. Folks around the world will see it online at WGXC.org, including some of these events.
On Tuesday, October 1st, featured art shown is by Paul Emile Rioux and Laura Gaton at the Hudson Underground on Warren Street from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. A selection of wines and culinary samples are included. The Catskill Town Board meets on the first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. with live web stream on WGXC.org. On Wednesday, October 2nd, award-winning writer Emily Sekar, founder of the Hudson Valley Memoir Collective, will be the guest speaker at a buffet luncheon sponsored by the Friends of the Hudson Area Library in the library's community room from 12 to 2 p.m. City of Hudson Board of Estimate and Apportionment Budget Workshop, focusing on the Department of Public Works, will be held at Hudson City Hall from 3 to 5 p.m. Rescheduled September 25th meeting of the Catskill Housing Authority Board will be held at the Catskill Housing Authority on Bronson Street at 4 p.m. The Hudson Underground hosts a peer-led and confidential group for LGBTQIA adults where anything can be discussed free of judgment, first and third Wednesdays of every month at 6 p.m. Slide guitarist and bandleader Sony Landreth performs at Club Helsinki Hudson at 8 p.m. On Thursday, October 3rd, in collaboration with the City of Hudson Senior Center and the Hudson Area Library, this class will focus on discovering the power of the inner self through the practice of daily writing. Taught by author, artist, educator, and social activist Maureen McNeil. Registration is limited at programs at hudsonarealibrary.org and is on a first-come, first-served basis. An evening curated by the Workers Unite Film Festival, featuring a tribute to local artist Bruce Anderson and a performance from Brooklyn-based Color Collage, Catskill's Gary's Dream, and Palinville's Potted Plant, and a screening of Final Cuts at the Avalon Lounge in Catskill from 7 to 11 p.m. with live web stream on WGXC.org. Les Filles de Il Giadad from Niger perform, led by Fatou Sidi Gali, at the Half Moon in Hudson at 8 p.m.
Wave Farm programs are made possible, in part, by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of Governor Andrew Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program administered in Greene County by the Greene County Council on the Arts, the Alexander and Marjorie Hover Foundation, the Foundation for Contemporary Arts, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Wendy Schmaltz of Claverick, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
WGXC welcomes audio responses from listeners. Anyone can call and leave a message with WGXC, and we'll play it on the air. Call 518-291-WGXC and leave up to a 3-minute message for airplay. Hear something you disagree with? Want to speak out on an issue? Plug your band's show? Let your neighbors know something important? Call 518-291-9492 and leave a 3-minute message anytime about any issue. That number again is 518-291-WGXC. 518-291-9492.
It's 9 o'clock on Monday night, and I guess you have a 2-hour show. Something about the dark side, you know, from 8 to 10. It's the absolute worst. Who decided to put this on the air instead of a local programmer or a local DJ? What's going on at that radio station? You guys, like, getting rid of all the local programmers and putting this stuff that I don't know what it is. It's just so bad. This program is especially awful. Has no place on a so-called, you know, creative, la-di-da, local radio station. Do us all a favor. Get rid of it.
Hello, this is Rob Gellis with This Month in History, a chronicle of significant or infamous events in art, science, music, literature, sports, and more that occurred this month either in the near or distant past. On October 1st, 1908, the first Model T car went on sale. It was priced for the working class and was designed by Henry Ford. On October 3rd, 1863, President Abraham Lincoln issued a proclamation designating the last Thursday in November as Thanksgiving Day. On October 5, 1830, Chester A. Arthur, the 21st President of the United States, was born in Fairfield, Vermont. He succeeded James Garfield, who was assassinated. On October 8, 1998, the U.S. House of Representatives voted 258-176 to approve a resolution launching an impeachment inquiry of President Bill Clinton. However, the Senate failed to impeach him. On October 11, 1884, Eleanor Roosevelt was born in New York City. She was the wife of President Roosevelt. As First Lady, she traveled all over the country as the eyes and ears of her husband. Later, Mrs. Roosevelt served as a U.S. delegate to the United Nations. On October 13, 1884, Greenwich, England was established as the universal time from which standard times throughout the world are calculated. On October 16, 1793, Queen Marie Antoinette was beheaded during the Reign of Terror following the French Revolution. On October 19, 1781, the British Army marched out in formation and surrendered to the American Army at Yorktown, Virginia. On October 21, 1879, Thomas Edison successfully tested an electric incandescent lamp at his laboratory in Menlo Park, New Jersey. On October 24, 1861, the first transcontinental telegram was sent from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. to President Lincoln. On October 28, 1886, the Statue of Liberty was dedicated on Bedloe's Island in New York Harbor. The statue was a gift from France to the United States. On October 31, 1952, the United States detonated its first hydrogen bomb on an atoll in the Pacific. You've been listening to This Month in History, a monthly broadcast of historic events on WGXC 90.7 FM. If you have an event that you'd like to hear included in This Month in History, email me, Rob Gellis, at info@wgxc.org.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
To come here and see the growing Latino community in Des Moines and in Iowa, it's fantastic to see. You have Mexican Americans, Puerto Ricans, Salvadorans. So it's exciting to see the community growing here and the folks that are powering different industries in Iowa more and more. So it's been great. You know, we've had some wonderful conversations.
That was Texas Representative Joaquin Castro, Democratic hopeful Julian Castro's twin brother. He campaigned for his brother at the Iowa Latino Heritage Festival Soapbox over the weekend. The Soapbox was co-sponsored by D.C.-based Latino Victory Foundation, part of a progressive collection of organizations co-founded by actress Eva Longoria. Here's Executive Director Myra Macias.
Why we're so interested in partnering up with the Soapbox is that we want to make sure that we're helping uplift local Latino organizations that are doing, you know, the hard work of educating and mobilizing the Latino community so that they're actively engaged.
Castro was not the only speaker at the Soapbox. Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard and former Pennsylvania Representative Joe Sestak spoke, as well as many Latino senior staff members of other candidates' campaigns.
It was just so powerful to hear from so many diverse Latino voices because, you know, the Latino community is not a monolith. And it was just so inspiring to see the various paths that people took to get the positions where they are. And despite, you know, whomever they're supporting or whomever they're campaigning for, to know that these folks are centering the Latino community in their work.
Some local Republican politicians did attend the Soapbox and speak. All of the Republican presidential candidates were invited, but none participated, including President Donald Trump, who's embroiled in the whistleblower scandal. This upcoming election cycle, the Latino community is on track to be the largest non-white ethnic voting bloc, with 32 million eligible voters, just over 13% of the voter population. According to a report from Pew Research Center, an increase in Hispanic and Asian populations since 2000 makes about a third of projected 2020 eligible voters non-white. Here's Marcias again.
That folks who may not be civically engaged, you know, see themselves represented or see folks that look like them advocating and centering our communities is just so powerful, and it's going to be so critical to making sure that we realize our political potential.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In recent decades, the education of girls around the world has increased dramatically. But climate change threatens to reverse some of that progress. Extreme weather can increase poverty and force families to leave their homes. In Bangladesh, for example, coastal flooding has forced many poor, rural people to migrate to Dhaka, a crowded megacity. Sanye Gulsar-Korat is director of the Division of Gender Equality at UNESCO, a UN agency. She says when families are forced to migrate, girls often take on additional responsibilities.
They take care of their siblings, they take care of the disabled and the elderly. They are hired out as help to others. So in most cases, even when education possibilities exist, girls are not usually the ones who can take advantage.
She says families struggling to survive may also encourage their teenage daughters to get married.
This is one less mouth to feed,
which tends to cut short their education. So she says climate change could be life-altering for women and girls around the globe. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
There's a reissue online of Brian DeWan's 1997 7-inch Free Lunch. Here is the children's story from J. Otto Seibold and Vivian Walsh, told by Catskill's Brian DeWan.
Free lunch, free lunch, free lunch, free lunch. Our story begins.
Mr. Lunch was very good at chasing birds. In fact, he was a professional. Every morning, Mr. Lunch liked to meet with the birds for bird chasing practice. To get ready to go really fast, Mr. Lunch would stretch his back and the birds would flap their wings.
One, two, three, four! One, two, three, four!
Afternoons were reserved for office work. There was a lot to do, such as reading the mail and placing birdseed orders.
Notice!
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 Change of elephant!
Change of elephant!
One afternoon, Mr. Lunch got a letter from the Elephant Brand Birdseed Company. It said there was a new elephant in charge. The old president was a good elephant with an excellent nose for seeds. Mr. Lunch wondered where he could have gone. Maybe the elephant went on one of his trips, thought Mr. Lunch. Mr. Lunch was happy to order some new seeds from the new elephant. But the new seeds did not make the birds happy. As time passed, the seeds became...
Birds, birds, rocks, rocks, rocks.
The matter was brought to Mr. Lunch's attention. He conducted a careful examination and determined that the seeds were indeed rocks. The birds didn't like rocks. Ambrose, the redbird, said, "I have an idea." He had a friend who lived in the country, surrounded by birdseed trees. "Maybe we should go visit," said Ambrose. Everybody liked Ambrose's idea. They gathered everything they would need to pick the seeds.
Wheelbarrow, field guide, ladder,
boot,
sack,
sack, basket,
and then drove off to find Ambrose's friend. Ambrose was happy to see his old friend. Her name was Gunhild. She showed them a good place to get started.
Welcome, Ambrose, welcome, Ambrose.
It was a lovely garden. But not everyone was so happy. High overhead, someone was spying on them. It was the new Birdseed Company elephant. He was very angry. He did not like to see birds eating free seeds. He did not like many things. He did not like Mr. Lunch. He hatched an evil elephant idea. Quickly, he painted a sign. It read, "Dogs must remain on a leash." Minutes later, the police arrived and arrested Mr. Lunch for being off the leash.
WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra.
Moments before he's hit with a 40-foot wall of sulfuric acid that will horribly burn everything in its path. Now, that's real acid, so I want to see goggles, people.
My eyes, the goggles do nothing.
It's almost always safety first at the Thingularity Radio program, so don't let that happen to you. Have your questions answered by sending them to catskillmakersinfo@gmail.com and tune in every first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM Accra or anytime at wgxc.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Shay Masterson of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
The Public News Service DOAA Newscast for Tuesday, October the 1st, 2019. I'm Mike Clifford. The Australian Prime Minister gets into the mix on Trump efforts to dig up dirt on Biden. Plus, could immigrants help fill the healthcare workforce gap? Topping our news, President Trump pushed the Australian Prime Minister during a recent call to help the Attorney General, Bill Barr, gather information for a Justice Department inquiry. The White House curbed access to a transcript of the call, which the President made at Barr's request. The New York Times notes the discussion with Prime Minister Morrison shows the extent to which Mr. Trump views the Attorney General as a critical partner. And immigrants could help Tennessee fill its health care workforce gap. That's according to a new report by the Business Forward Foundation.
Foreign-born individuals currently make up less than 5% of the state's total population. President of the foundation, Jim Doyle, says the number of Tennessee seniors.
You're listening to a live town hall meeting in Dutchess County in Rhinebeck from Representative Antonio Delgado.
Irrespective of party affiliation, making sure that we continue to do the work to bring folks together, hopefully across the political spectrum. This district is politically diverse. A third independent, a third Democrat, a third Republican. If we can't figure out how to get along here, find common ground here, I worry. I have good news, because every time I've gone across the district and held town halls with another bunch, people show up just like this. We can have civil discourse. We can disagree, but do so agreeably, remembering that we all have more or less the same shared values. We all care about the same types of things, our kids' futures, good-paying jobs. Good health care. Make sure that we actually take pride in where we live, protect our environment along the way. And it's not just the town halls. 5 offices have opened up to make sure that we can do the work on the ground for you. One in Delhi in Delaware County, one in Oneonta in Oswego County, Livingston in Sullivan County, Hudson in Columbia County, Kingston in Ulster County. And if we don't have one in the county, we'll come to you. We have mobile office hours. We'll come out, we'll connect, make sure we talk to you about all the issues that matter that you're concerned about. And it's not just that. We have 4 local-based advisory And if we don't have one in the county, we'll come to you. We have mobile office hours. We'll come out, we'll connect, make sure we talk to you about all the issues that matter that you're concerned about. And it's not just that. We have 4 local-based advisory in Ulster County. And if we don't have one in the county, we'll come to you. We have mobile office hours. We'll come out, we'll connect, make sure we talk to you about all the issues that matter that you're concerned about. And it's not just that. We have 4 local-based advisory committees that are bipartisan. And if we don't have one in the county, we'll come to you. We have mobile office hours. We'll come out, we'll connect, make sure we talk to you about all the issues that matter that you're concerned about. And it's not just that. We have 4 local-based advisory committees that are bipartisan.
Sorry, the congressperson is holding a town hall meeting on broadband, rural broadband in this area. And he can talk about how his own town hall meetings are unable to be web streamed.
And if we don't have one in the county, we'll come to you. We have mobile office hours. We'll come out, we'll connect, make sure we talk to you about all the issues that matter that you're concerned about. And it's not just that. We have 4 local-based advisory committees that are bipartisan. Ulster County. And if we don't have one in the county, we'll come to you. We have mobile office hours. We'll come out, we'll connect, make sure we talk to you about all the issues that matter that you're concerned about. And it's not just that. We have 4 local-based advisory committees that are bipartisan. Ulster County. And if we don't have one in the county, we'll come to you. We have mobile office hours. We'll come out, we'll connect, make sure we talk to you about all the issues that matter that you're concerned about. And it's not just that. We have 4 local-based advisory committees
that are bipartisan. Mercer County. And if we don't have one in the county, we'll come to you. We have mobile office hours. We'll come out, we'll connect, make sure we talk to you about all the issues that matter that you're concerned about. And it's not just that. We have four local-based advisory committees that are bipartisan.
The IT guys. Mm-hmm. Who else did
anybody get a hold of the senior center?
All right, there's not enough rural broadband to bring you the town hall meeting from the local congressperson, so we're going to the town of Catskill meeting.
So I needed these dates, mm-hmm. and now we'll send out a letter and a request. Okay.
Motion
to accept the dates of the next four Tuesdays in October, 6:30. Second from motion from Patrick, second from Paul. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is carried. And resolution. I got a free offer in the mail to do a cable franchise off. All they do is look at our data, and they've got some pretty good data that tells you how much you may not be getting from franchise fees.
Well, they go directly to the customer anyways, and they're a big franchise. They get reflected onto the customer's bill. So the more we charge them, the more the customer's bill is going to be.
But if they wrote us a check for $35,000, then we were supposed to get $65,000.
Oh, money we're not getting. Okay, I thought you meant money we could charge more.
This is the same thing that we did with Central Hudson when we started to do the inventory.
It's free, let's know.
It's free. I'm thinking we reach into these people and at least have them give us a presentation as to how they do it.
Yeah, see if they have done this in other municipalities and then maybe reach out to them.
And I'd like to know locally if anybody's done it. Yeah. Share. Okay? I'll follow up on that and let you know what I find out. Cornell University Project, they are going to bring 12 to 15 people. They have a visiting professor coming in also who is architecture and design specialist plus four grad students. And they're going to have two minivans and they're going to go around and do an inventory and have a meeting or a poster board session at the Senior Center Saturday from 1:30 to 3:30. And then we'll get...
One thing we should all be able to agree on is it should be as easy as possible to comply with regulations. My bipartisan bill, which you're getting passed the House, creates one-stop-shop website that allows all businesses to go to that website and figure out exactly how to comply on one website. So the cost of compliance is drastically brought down, and that is a lifesaver for our small business owners. Relatedly, I introduced a bill that allows our sole proprietors, including farmers, to be able to deduct their premiums, their health care premiums, as a business expense, which currently they cannot do. Would save about $750 annually for our small business owners, small sole proprietors, and farmers as well. The third bill that I got through the House is the CLEAR Act, which was a part of the Democrats'
which
to me was a critical legislation because all the corruption we have in our system.
Request from business owners and lead.
HR1 is a tremendous job of trying to clean up this mess through a host of ways. First, it allows for independent commissions to draw our congressional districts rather self-interested elected officials, so you don't get these super red and super blue seats and you have no chance for compromise or finding common ground. It also matches individual contributions from public support, so that those from limited means have a chance to actually run for office and engage in the system and not be priced out. It also allows for Election Day to be a holiday. You would think by now that would be the case for a lot of folks to come out and vote. For electoral security, paper ballots, helping our states make sure they can withstand any more future meddling by a foreign adversary. And then, critically important, is the bill that I introduced called the CLEAR Act. And the CLEAR Act puts a spotlight on those FEC reports. So when you get these donors who support candidates that often don't know what they do, particularly if they're lobbyists, it's helpful to be able to look at that FEC report, see who that donor is, and if they're a lobbyist, okay, say they're a lobbyist and who they lobby for. Sunlight is a powerful disinfectant. And I think it's important that we shed some sunlight on these reports so electeds are held accountable to the folks who are putting money in their pockets and for what reason. Because here's the issue. Here's the issue. We have got the highest level of income inequality in this country since we started recording it in 1967. The highest level. 0.1% of this entire country shares a fifth of all the wealth. Two-thirds of this country is getting by paycheck to paycheck. And when access to our democracy depends on your price and your ability to access it through your means and your money, a lot of us are being priced out. And there's a reason why we can't get things done. And so for me, making sure we deal with this corruption and all the money in politics is incredibly important. A few more points, if I may. May I?
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about veterans. The first bill that I introduced, the bipartisan bill called the Service Disabled Veterans Continuation Act. This bill would extend benefits to the spouses of service disabled veterans. Too often we don't think enough about the sacrifice that our families are making, not just the veterans themselves, but the families of these individuals. In the same vein, we were able to do some work to incentivize employers to not just hire veterans, but to hire through tax credits the spouses of veterans. Again, finding ways to support the unit that is putting up the ultimate sacrifice to defend and protect our rights and our liberties here at home. PFAS, another big factor for our military service members. Those who are exposed to PFAS on military sites. Now, PFAS is a horrible toxin that can cause cancer, autoimmune disorders, thyroid disease, and we are just now seeing how devastating this can be. Well, it's on the move, it's on the march. In fact, we saw it up in Hoosick Falls, and we saw it in Petersburg in Rensselaer County, and how it's devastating that community. So I'm doing a lot of work to make sure we track those in the veteran community who are exposed to PFAS. Relatedly, we also got the TRI, the Toxic Release Inventory Bill. That means you put PFAS on that inventory so that we as a government can track who's using this substance and to what degree. And we can proactively get out in front of it and not just be reactive when people end up being hurt or harmed, but proactive and prevent the harm from happening in the first place. Three more points. Healthcare. Now, for those who follow me, you know that I talk a lot about public option when I ran for this. I think a public option is a critical way forward, essential way forward. Where we can allow folks the choice to opt in to Medicare. That choice does not destroy the insurance marketplace. The insurance marketplace can continue, but now it has a public floor in its midst. And you better believe when you allow that public floor to operate, it'll drive down premiums, drive down deductibles, and make it more fair for the consumer to acquire affordable health care. I have a bill that I introduced at my office, the Medicare X Choice Act. I'm the only freshman member of Congress that can say I've introduced a bill that'll get us to universal health care. And that bill has a companion bill with Michael Bennett and Kane in the Senate. So we have laid down the roots here for something that I think can make a lot of sense in the future. The same bill includes and gives the power of Medicare to negotiate with the pharmaceutical industry, which is a travesty. The fact that Medicare cannot negotiate drug prices but the pharmaceutical industry is insane. That would be like you walking into a car dealership and saying to the dealer, you know what, give me whatever you think I should buy. Give me the price tag. I'm just going to forego my power to negotiate. Instead, in this case, it's the government who's supposed to be representing our interests
ceding its full faith and credit and power for the betterment of private actors who paid for them to do that in the first place. That's called corruption. That's called corruption, full stop, and it needs to end. Now, we have healthcare. Lastly, green jobs. The green jobs, sorry, now I want to do more. Opioids, before we get to green jobs. Opioids. Another pill that I introduced, a bipartisan bill, Mainstream Addiction Treatment Act. I've heard too many stories from folks who've had devastating losses in this space. What kills me is that we got physicians who are allowed to prescribe to kingdom come the opioids. There's no caps on how many opioids you can prescribe to anybody, but there are caps on the treatment. So Suboxone, buprenorphine, these things that are meant to help folks deal with the disease of addiction, you gotta seek a special waiver if you wanna be able to prescribe. No such waiver exists when you prescribe the highly addictive opioids. So I teamed up with my colleagues across the aisle and issued a bill called the Mainstream Addiction Treatment Act, which would lift the CAP requirement and allow folks to treat this disease for what it is, this addiction for what it is. That's a real disease. I think that's an important step in dealing with opioids. Lastly, I promise, we have to deal with the climate change crisis. It's affecting so many. I hear you. It's affecting so many folks in so many ways. You know, from Lyme disease. The reason why we have increased Lyme disease cases is because of the uptick in climate change. And we here in our community get hit the hardest because we have the highest levels of Lyme disease. And I've got to mention that when we're funding the government, I introduced an amendment in the appropriations to get more funding for research and development in Lyme disease, because we need a lot more of it. So Lyme disease, climate change, our farming community, the health of our soil. How can you farm when the soil is not healthy? How can you farm when you can't predict the seasons? We don't have four seasons anymore. We have two, hot and cold. That's it. That's a problem, the extreme weather events. How do you get out in front of this? We have an administration that's rolling back all the protections, making it more and more difficult to rein this problem in. Lyme introduced the Green Jobs Opportunities Act. This bill will do a study on what jobs we need to create and fill by 2050 to get to net zero carbon emissions. If we don't figure out what those jobs are, we're going to be in trouble. If we don't fill them, we're going to be in more trouble. We find that information, and then we work our butts off to figure out how we can invest in community colleges, high schools, middle schools, and create apprenticeship programs from the ground up and train individuals for those exact jobs. And that is how you get a green economy for the future in a practical way that both addresses the needs of our environment, but also creates an economy that flourishes and good paying jobs that are sustainable for folks all across the region. Now, I could keep going, but I'm gonna stop because I think it's important that we have a dialogue. I did want to take a little bit of time. It's been a while since I just talked to folks here at home to give you an update on the work that we've been doing. Real work for the people, for you. And I hope that as we have this conversation, we can do so in a fashion that allows us to continue to build off of the feed chain, the loop chain. So whatever you give me, I can take that with me to DC. Because I'm good to listen. I really am. Only one rule I have for town halls. Just one. We don't screen questions. You know, we call anybody at any time. My only rule is that if you ask, you raise your hand, you don't just do a monologue. In fact, I prefer to skip the monologue and just give you the question. I think for everybody's time sake, I just did the monologue, right? So now we can do questions. And with that, let's open it up. Yes. Yes, so the question is about aging and more senior-oriented issues. In fact, we are in the works, as we speak, putting together a committee that is focused on more senior-oriented issues and the impacts of that. As I said, I was in Cobleskirk earlier today, meeting with executives and staff and nurses in one of the positions in that hospital and going through the issues that they were facing. And one of them that they flagged for me was literally the whole county. Scary, no nursing
zilch. Zero in the entire county. That's pretty devastating. And then recruiting caretakers as well, right? In the absence of things like broadband, affordable housing, cell services, it's hard to get folks to want to stay and care for or come and care for. So this is something that I'm certainly focused on and do want to do more and more work in this space to help these single-oriented issues in the aging dynamic. So I appreciate that. Yes?
Well, you just spoke of a plan to get us to carbon neutrality by 2050, which is great, but that's actually 20 years past what scientists tell us we need to do. So we talked to you about a year ago with the Sunrise Movement, and you said you're not supporting the deal. A lot has happened since then. Climate change has gotten a lot worse, and the political possibilities have changed. So we asked you again, will you support a Green New Deal to get us off the fossil fuel by the time scientists tell us it's necessary to do catastrophic?
Well, listen, I appreciate your work. I appreciate your commitment and dedication. I think it's critically important that you continue to focus on what you focus on. In no way, shape, or form am I here to push back against that effort. But I have not signed on. Instead, I've chosen to focus on what I think I can advocate aggressively for and get done. One of the things that I've tried to do in this space is highlight what we can specifically do, what we can specifically do to deal with carbon emissions. It is not just creating green jobs. It's contemplating things that the carbon fee didn't, right? Which I think we have to actually unpack and address and not just get lost in the weeds and big ticket items, but what can we specifically pursue that can bring down carbon emissions? It's transitioning from propping up the fossil fuel industry with tax credits and subsidies they no longer need and taking that and moving it over into the renewable energy space where there's actual growth economically for opportunities there and ways to help our environment be more sustainable. It's also making sure we have built-in tax credits for our farmers to have an opportunity to use carbon sequestration techniques to be able to help facilitate our ability to deal with climate change. So I just listed about four or five specific things, none of which actually are included in the Green New Deal, that speak to the problem of how we can address carbon emission, or the question of how we can address carbon emissions and literally deal with the climate change crisis. I respect the overarching. In fact, that was the first thing I talked about was the Green Jobs Opportunities Act, creating green jobs in a fashion that will allow us to invest in the training of young people all the way up through high school, through college, and then in an hour, I mean, this is part of my bill, you should prioritize the folks who actually work in the fossil fuel industry, because they're having to deal with the actual harsh reality of making this transition. And for a long time, no one had a problem with the work that was being done. So now we've got to figure out a way to ease that transition in a way that gets more and more folks on board. This is a huge enterprise. I get it. Time is not on our side, and I totally understand from a young person's perspective. You know, you want to pull your hair out. I get it. I got young kids. And we're twin boys, and they're a handful. And I think a lot about this work that they're about to inherit. So I just hope you understand that my decision here is not meant to throw shade at the work you're doing. I think it's important work that you're doing, and I commend it. I just think there's a lane that I can play in this overarching project that can be critical and helpful for us in obtaining and reaching our shared goals. Yeah, I'll come over here next.
And thank you for all the work that you're doing and for coming back so often also. I have a question about impeachment, and that has to do with the campaign finance.
You're listening to Representative Antonio Delgado live in Rhinebeck on WGXC Acre 90.7 FM.
Well, listen, I mean, this is...
What's the question?
I'm sorry, thank you. The question was about the campaign piece and the manner in which there are, within the impeachment umbrella, right, there are a host of different areas, one of which is campaign financing and how you are financed and the ways in which that financing was acquired and
ways in which it may or may not have been used for purposes that aren't deemed legitimate, but this is all part of one piece of the umbrella inquiry. And the question was, well, you know, how do we get to the bottom of these things if the agencies or the departments that are meant to sort of help with facilitating getting to the bottom? That is the kind of question that is a hard one to answer. because it's the same kind of dilemma one finds oneself in when we're talking about protecting the environment. And the head of the EPA has made it their mission to undermine the mission of the EPA. It's the same sort of concept we have with the HUD, with Ben Carson saying that poverty is a state of mind. This is the head of HUD. It's the same you get with Betsy DeVos, who hasn't visited a public school to figure out what the problem is and how she can address the concerns. If every head of agency has at the helm somebody who has made it their career to not be a part of the solution, but to actually be a part of the problem, well, we find ourselves in a rather broken system. And I don't have a good answer. I do know that there are three branches of government. I think the judiciary will continue to have to play a role in terms of us navigating access to information. They'll continue to have to play a role in sort of being the referee and calling balls and strikes on who can get what and when and from who and how. And hopefully these checks and balances will work themselves through. I will say, though, that there are a lot of different things that are being investigated. And I think, as I've said repeatedly, it's worth investigating. I do think that the last set of facts around Ukraine, there's a qualitative difference in the sense that we're talking about, at least on its face, a matter of urgent and credible concern. And the language of urgency there, and the way it sort of includes and almost puts it in its own lane here in terms of what we have to do to get to the bottom of it and quickly and go from there.
Antonio, I can't quite say you represent me. I'm in your district. I'm disappointed. I read your bio. My question is real simple. I would like you to identify tonight the exact crimes that you think have been committed, the crime that causes you to think impeachment versus the head of the country, the ability to talk to other countries.
Yes.
On varieties of it.
Yes.
So identify the exact crimes that
Absolutely.
You think happened.
Happy to do so. First of all, I want to thank you for coming. I appreciate the question.
I called your office last week.
Good. Well, next time, hopefully.
I was 11 miles away.
Hopefully, I'll get you on the phone. But I'm happy you're here, front row. First, I'm going to answer the question of crimes, because there is an answer. But I also want to address your important point. And I hope no one takes from my decision that I think we should be shining a spotlight on every single phone call our presidents have with the heads of states, four heads of states. I don't see value in that as a general principle. I don't. I think we need to make sure that, there are discussions that are allowed to happen that can work themselves out. At the end of the day, we should owe a little bit of that to the president. The difference in this situation is that this came from a whistleblower.
Second hand.
But I'm just saying the genesis of how this unfolded. Right? It wasn't that there was a sort of outside-in approach that was coming. It was an inside-out approach. And that's the distinction here. There was somebody inside who was he's basically the complaint talking to more than a half dozen individuals. And they were coordinating around what they were seeing. And he or she was ultimately in the position to file the complaint. That's the distinction. On the crime piece.
Right.
U.S. code, the number I think is 5120, quote me on that, but somewhere in that range. You can, just do me the favor if you can. There is a U.S. code, there's a statute. The statute makes it pretty clear that it is a crime to solicit any of valor from a foreign national when seeking office or for any sort of electoral purpose. That is the letter of the law. You do not have to receive any. No, you just have to solicit. What is the thing of value in this instance? The thing of value in this instance is to say, hey, Zelensky, could you investigate my political rival? And I don't know if it's that far-fetched, and I'm happy to hear you out on this one, but it's not that far-fetched to conclude that an investigation into a political rival, by the way, an investigation that had already been undergone and closed with no findings, by that foreign country, to reopen and hopefully bring about something that can muddy the waters for the benefit of the current occupant in the White House. That's a value. So to solicit that, right? And here's the thing that also I just want to highlight. I didn't phrase it because I think it still needs to be worked itself out. It's not the reason why I felt compelled to move forward with the inquiry. But I think this bears worth noting. At the time this discussion was happening, military aid to Ukraine for the purpose of fending off the Russian attack, which also was meant to protect our own soldiers, by the way, who were on the ground there, was being withheld. Despite it having already been appropriated on a bipartisan basis by Congress. Days before that conversation, the aid was withheld. So that's just circumstantial evidence. The direct evidence is the president's admission that he solicited. He said, yes, I asked him to investigate. Now it's a crime. But even irrespective of that, there's an abuse of power. And the abuse of power, too, layers over that crime in a way that I can really create a level of urgency and worth it. Yes?
Back to the question of green jobs in Vernon, and we're volunteer for senior country and the state fish and wildlife, so my concern is right now. Every time I hear of the EPA rescinding a regulation or restriction or something that diminishes clean air or clean water, or allows more use of poisonous pesticides, I say, well, what power do we have to stop the EPA from canceling those regulations? I mean, are they self-beholden to corporations and law courses? We need clean air, clean water. That's the only thing we're powerless. But I feel powerless that these administrators are saying it's okay to use German Nurofen as a pesticide. Boom.
No, listen,
is there a microphone for the gentleman?
I can repeat. I'll repeat. The question was, piggybacking off the gentleman's question about the environment and what are we going to do about the fact that the folks who are supposed to be, the gatekeepers and protecting the environment are the ones actually causing the problems, rolling back the regulations. And, this is the fight that we're in. I mean, we have a president in an administration right now that has rolled back, the standards we've had for automobiles, pollution standards. And we had folks out in California saying we're going to still move forward with it, irrespective of what you guys want us to do, which is pretty mind-boggling, right? And then you had the fire code regulations that were rolled back under the current administration. They're allowing for drilling. We just had to pass legislation out of the House to protect the Arctic and coastal plains, right, from exploration. So we're going to keep doing what we're doing to fight and fight aggressively against this administration. But this is where, and I hate to say this because it sounds a little bit dismissive, but I don't mean it to be. Elections matter. And, when you put somebody in the White House who doesn't believe that climate change is real, and that there's science there to deal with it, if that's the person elected, do we expect anything else? So the challenge has to be, how do we continue to focus on these issues and identify individuals
who are willing to fight and stand up for the environment, who won't take a bunch of money from the fossil fuel industries, right, and then become beholden to that industry at our future's expense, right? And we have to do that work. And that means getting more money out of politics. That also means everybody getting out there and engaging more. And that means holding all elected officials accountable. And we're going to keep doing the work legislatively, clearly, to keep getting out in front of this. But in a divided country, in a divided government, it's a hard thing to kind of work through at this point. And I understand your frustration.
It's helpless. If the minister is okay to use such and such points that we, you and I, have nothing to fight back.
Yeah, I understand the word helpless. Don't feel helpless. Don't feel helpless. You know, there's a lot of reasons to be helpless. There's a lot of reasons why you might think it's, you know, you want to throw your hands in the air. But at the end of the day, you always have the power. You always have the power to do something about it. And it might not be right now, right? But you always have the capacity to exercise your rights, to get out there, be heard, listen, vote, and be a part of the process. And whether that change happens now or later, you know, you still gotta be a part of it. And I'll just say on that point, you know, for those who don't know, right, this district is 90% white, okay? I'm not a white master. You can see. The district is incredibly rural. The third most rural seat of any Democrat in Congress, and eighth in the entire country, okay? The third independent, the third Republican, the third Democrat. And they spent about, I can't tell you how many millions and millions of dollars last election cycle about my rap career, making me out to be all types of nonsense, okay? And the reason why I bring all that up is because you would think from the outside looking in, that's insurmountable. There's no way. You might even feel helpless. You might. But we didn't. And you just gotta continue to do the work. And I believe in this community, and I believe in what we can do together to be an example. Yes.
Your man, Matt, is wonderful.
Oh, Matt. I love you.
Thank you for coming here, Congressman, to our little town and talking to us this evening.
Good evening.
My question is this. Given what we all know is going on with this impending impeachment, and all indications are to me that there is going to be an impeachment, whether or not the man's actually going to be removed from office, I think that's a bigger question. But I'm just wondering if you think there's any appetite once this has been resolved, whenever that's going to be, in the Democratic majority House to do away with the Electoral College?
I mean, here's my thought on the Electoral College. With the Electoral College that is, you know, pertinent in terms of understanding its origins and sort of how it came to pass, which you can make a case is, you know, not ideal. At the end of the day, though, to try to take that type of, I would argue, really robust structural change to, you know, the workings of our democracy is to skip about 10 different steps that are actually more achievable before you even get there. That is a Herculean task.
Such as?
So well, we can start with passing H.R. 1. Because H.R. 1 is meant to deal with the issues you're talking about. When the popular vote is able to be suppressed, or when you have the ability to suppress votes in competitive states, swing states, if you will. Well, if you pass legislation like H.R. 1, which includes a language that bans the practices that lead to voter suppression, what do I mean? There's a practice right now where if you don't vote, in the last election cycle, well, we could just erase your name from the rolls. Sorry for you. Another practice, we can forward, we email you, sorry, mail you non-forwardable mail. If we don't get a response, we can take you off the rolls. These are actual practices that are being employed in parts of the country that are up for grabs. Pretty harsh to think of that. It's pretty shameful, but they're real. HR1 deals with that. A lot of folks in certain parts of the country, more rural parts of the country, who are trying to get by, working 3 or 4 jobs, can't find childcare. It's hard to go vote. Hard to find time to vote. When you gotta put food in your kids' mouths and might not have the car you need or the gas to get to where you gotta go. You gotta make a hard choice, right? Well, if you make it a holiday, you make it a lot easier for folks of limited means to go exercise their right. And you better believe that'll have an effect on turnout in these critical parts of the country. Let the people vote. You get money out of politics. I'm not considering to say overturning Citizens United is easy. It's not. But the fact that we allow unlimited amounts of money to pour into our system, it in effect creates an oligarchy where all the access points are from the wealth point. If you're not in that world, you don't have access. I mean, think about it. Why is it that we have a government that will do away with our own power to negotiate with the pharmaceutical industry? The vast majority of us look at that and think that's crazy. Why don't we do that? Because a small elite has the capacity to pay for it. Simple and plain. Why is it when 90% of Americans want background checks? 90% want universal background checks. Mom's the man action, right? We can't get even that through. Not even that. When 90% of the country, I'm not sure there's a better example of how broken the system is. When you have 90% of folks who want to get something done, and a handful of gun manufacturers can say, no, not gonna happen. So making sure we get money out of politics, and the HR1 bill does that, has matching public financing dollars that allows the reduces the influence of money in politics. So those are a set of things that we can be doing that I think are actually more achievable than saying, let's do away with the whole electoral college. I'll get you next. That's easy.
Obviously, as you said, we have an administration that denies the scientific consensus that climate change is real, the humans are causing it. But that's not the only scientific consensus on climate change, right? The scientific community also said that we have 11 years left to avoid irreversible climate catastrophe. Obviously, we've experienced a year of climate catastrophe. Europe saw this summer in sort of history. Hurricane Dorian, the Amazon rainforest, there's many examples. My question is, would you make a public announcement on the floor of Congress declaring a climate emergency?
I keep forgetting. Keep in mind, given the severity of the problem, the emergency that we are now confronted with, which I don't think is up to debate, it's scientific, would I be willing to, from the House floor, call the note as the climate emergency? I'm not going to say yes right now, only because I don't like to just say I'm going to do something without actually thinking through what it is I'm going to do before I decide to do it. But I will tell you this. Make sure you connect with my team here. Amanda, Sarah, there's Amanda. We'll get your information. And I'm going to think about what you're asking me, figure out exactly what it entails. And one way or the other, we will get back to you. You will hear from me on this question. I'm telling you right there.
Okay.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Congressman. I manned the phones to try to help get you where you are today, and I have to say, I felt like it was a lesson in futility. making the calls, but I'm nonetheless really happy that you got elected. I guess what I'm wondering is what are your people doing that groups like Move On and Indivisible, they seem to be able to reach me and get their message out in a much more cutting edge way than I felt like, you know, during your campaign you were able to. And I guess I'm concerned that that the pieces might not be in place to help you get your message out there in a way that, you know, as a small business owner, we have to always look at branding and things that are really effective. And I'd love to see you accomplish those things.
Well, I appreciate your concern. I'll be honest with you, it's not mine right now. I'm 8 months in the job. And I will tell you, a two-year term is brutal, particularly when you factor in the money piece and how insane that aspect is. But I'm not thinking about, you know, campaign. I'm thinking about government. I'm thinking about doing this work and making sure that the work can speak for itself. And we have a lot more time ahead of us here. We're not even in 2020 yet. So I'm focusing on making sure that I'm working on healthcare. I'm working on rural broadband. Did I plug the fact, and maybe I didn't plug this fact, but I'm going to now. On Friday, we are having a public field hearing. Did I mention this? Public field hearing at Columbia Green Community College. We are having the commissioner from the FCC, Jeffrey Stark, has been kind enough to come to the district and join me and other stakeholders in the rural broadband space to do a field hearing. It's at, like I said, the Columbia Green Community College Arts Center, 1 p.m. if you can make it. I know it's the middle of the day, but we'd love to have you there. We sent out a bunch of flyers to get folks there. It's a very important issue. And this is the kind of work that I'm going to keep focusing on to make sure that we're helping folks here. And there'll be a time for your questions, sir. And I appreciate your concern. I really do. I feel like there's a lot of men raising questions.
I hope everyone can hear me. I can hear that you are concerned about inequality, about the climate change, and that's why you support green jobs. You frame it as green jobs. And you support universal healthcare system. So my question is, if you support these two things, why you don't support the Green New Deal that already combines these two things and many other concerns that people have, like an aging population and childcare? Why not support a Green New Deal?
The reason why I haven't supported that is because my focus is to not be a part of something that can be exploited or manipulated or, you know, used to demagogue in a fashion that I don't find particularly helpful. It'd be one thing if I was sitting on my hands not pursuing legislation to meet the end goal, but I am. And if you look at the track record, you look at what I've been doing specifically in this space, it speaks for itself. I am committed, you know, to making sure we attack this problem head on. I have spoken up loudly and clearly, consistently on this space, and I will continue to do so. I just have chosen that, from my vantage point, I would prefer to be able to define who I am in this space on my own terms, rather than be defined by somebody else and how that might be spun out by somebody else. Again, not to discourage the work you're doing and the folks who join the work you're doing, keep at it. I have a lane that I'm in. I hope you can see me as an ally in this fight, because I'm going to keep doing this work to make sure that we can address this climate crisis. Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Three quick yes-no questions, then one you can expound on.
I missed the...
Three quick yes-no questions.
Right.
They're quick. Are you realize that in Athens, New York, a natural gas-fired power plant went bankrupt a couple of years ago? Okay. Do you realize that in New York and New England, we don't need any more new generating capacity of electricity until about 2027? And do you realize that in Dover Plains, New York, there is a 1,100 megawatt natural gas burning power plant being built, situated 3/4 of a mile from a high school? Now, the question is, what are you doing to stop the expansion of the natural gas and oil industry all across the country, and especially in New York State?
Well, I stand by the fracking ban. I think it's important. We must continue that, and not just the ban of the practice of fracking, but the emerging practice of virtual pipelines, where you have big old trucks, you know, delivering, natural gas, and putting our families and young people in harm's way as a result. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. When we're talking about, pipes and fossil fuels and natural gas infrastructure, I don't think any of that stuff needs to be happening when we have not considered first, what the alternative infrastructure would be and how that would be implemented. So for any projects that proceed in that fashion without having some sort of documentation that says, well, here's another project or here's another avenue that we could provide energy through renewable sources, that needs to be the sort of modus operandi. That needs to be how we operate moving forward in this space. I think if we do that kind of work, we'll be able to have the ability to get out in front of what you're talking about. But I mentioned this earlier as well. We have this disincentivized economically investment in the space, right? So right now we're propping up the industry and we're incentivizing investment in it. So if you have tax subsidies and credits, billions of which on an annual basis are being thrown at the fossil fuel industry, we're incentivizing the behavior. We're not disincentivizing the behavior. So take away the tax credits, take away the subsidies, and disincentivize the behavior and move all those incentives into the renewable energy space, into the space of people. Follow the money, follow the incentives, and I think that is how we can get ourselves through this process. Yes. No, right behind you, right in the back. The lovely one. Yes, right here.
I'll get in there yet. Pardon me, I called your office recently, but not enough time to get the response. So here's the question. It seems like the scintillating issue of the country is the economy.
Yes.
And then along comes the comment on the radio that said, this, at the moment, we have the biggest spread in wealth between the left and the right. The right are the ones with the right amount of money. Now, I want to follow that question with this question. How about finding out the amount of food stamps of the people just before the election and the amount of food stamps that are needed now? Then I think we can start seeing the difference between what real wealth means and what the economy means.
Well, I thank you for your question. It's about inequality, wealth inequality, and the food stamp example is a good one. It's such an important point in terms of how we talk about the economy. And the economy, you're right, it is at the heart of a lot of what people fundamentally care about. We can tend to forget that in this current environment. And you'll have folks who will say the economy is humming right now. You'll turn the radio on, you turn the TV on, people say we have the lowest unemployment rate in history. People are investing and the economy is growing. Now, those are all facts. Okay, the unemployment level is really low. And the economy in scale and size is growing. So those are the facts. The problem is it's a sugar high. And we've lived this before. When you have, as we have done, passed legislation that